You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Boston College. Today is Sunday, May 31st, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is a place where truth does not whisper. It does not bow. It does not wait for permission. Here, truth steps forward with its full weight, unhidden and unafraid. Urgency is not a mood here. It is a pulse. Clarity is not optional. It is a responsibility. And while our focus remains on Palestine, on the West Bank, on Gaza, we also follow the stories that move beneath the surface of the world. Stories that may unfold oceans away, yet shape Palestinian life in ways that are often unseen, but deeply felt. Wherever you are right now, whether driving through the long stretch of night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or listening in the quiet of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. On this program, we do not smooth the edges of reality. We do not dilute the truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not rewrite the story for comfort. This is a space where truth is unfiltered, where resistance is not an idea, but a lived experience, where solidarity is not a slogan, but a thread carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land are steady and unbroken. They stand beside movements across the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is not isolated. It is shared. This hour is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the darkest moments, the ember of defiance remains. Even when the world turns away, that ember refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, humanity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes are too high for anything less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for liberation is shared. It is global, and it is sacred. Do you ever stop and ask yourself why we keep doing things that harm us? Not just the obvious things, the cigarettes we swore we'd quit, the drinks we promised to cut back on, the habits we know are slowly eating away at our health. I'm talking about something deeper, something collective, something we do as a society again and again, even when the consequences are staring us in the face. Why do we cling to things that hurt us? Why do we defend what destroys us? Why do we protect the very forces that pull us into darkness? Maybe it's human nature. Maybe it's denial. Maybe it's fear. Or maybe, and this is the hardest truth, maybe we've been conditioned to believe that the harm is necessary, that the pain is justified, that the cost is worth it. But then, There's the biggest question of all, the one we avoid because it cuts too close to the bone. Why are so many people blindly supporting Israel, even when the evidence of suffering is undeniable? Why do governments, institutions, and individuals put themselves in the worst possible positions, morally, politically, spiritually, just to defend a system that has been accused of racism, displacement, and the erasure of an entire people's culture and land? Why do we keep biting the hand that feeds us while applauding the hand that strikes someone else? These are not easy questions. They are not comfortable questions, but they are necessary questions. Because when you look at the pattern, the unwavering political loyalty, the silence in the face of injustice, the excuses made for violence, the justifications offered for oppression, you start to see something that feels less like support and more like addiction. Yes, addiction. The addiction to a narrative, the addiction to a myth, the addiction to a story that has been repeated so many times that people fear what will happen if they stop believing it. Addiction is not just about substances. It's about dependency. It's about clinging to something even when it's destroying you or destroying someone else.
And that's what we're witnessing. A world addicted to a narrative that excuses suffering. A world addicted to a political alliance that demands silence. A world addicted to the idea that supporting Israel, no matter the cost, is somehow a moral obligation. But addiction always has consequences. It clouds judgment. It distorts reality. It makes people defend the indefensible. It makes governments sacrifice their own credibility. It makes leaders choose loyalty over humanity. And the result? A global community that keeps putting itself in worse and worse positions, diplomatically, ethically, spiritually, just to maintain a relationship that demands more than it gives, takes more than it offers, and punishes anyone who dares to question it. But here's the truth. No addiction lasts forever. Eventually, the damage becomes too visible. Eventually, the cost becomes too high. Eventually, the excuses stop working. And when that moment comes, when people finally look at what they've been defending, what they've been enabling, what they've been ignoring, the shock is overwhelming. Because deep down, we all know the truth. We know that supporting injustice is not sustainable. We know that defending oppression corrodes the soul. We know that silence in the face of suffering is complicity. So why do we keep doing it? Maybe because it's easier to follow the script than to rewrite it. Maybe because it's easier to repeat the talking points than to confront the truth. Maybe because it's easier to stay blind than to open our eyes and see what's really happening.
But blindness is a choice, and choices can change. We can choose to question. We can choose to learn. We can choose to break the cycle. We can choose to stop supporting systems that harm others and harm us in the process. Because the moment we stop pretending, the moment we stop repeating the same harmful patterns, the moment we stop defending what we know is wrong, that is the moment we begin to heal. That is the moment we reclaim our humanity. That is the moment we step out of the darkness and into the light. And maybe, just maybe, that is the moment we finally understand that supporting justice is not a burden. It is a responsibility. It is a privilege. It is the only path forward. So ask yourself again, why do we keep doing things that are bad for us? Why do we keep defending what harms others? Why do we keep choosing blindness over truth?
Okay. And then ask yourself the most important question of all. What would happen if we stopped? What would happen if we chose clarity instead of confusion? What would happen if we chose courage instead of fear? What would happen if we chose justice instead of loyalty to a narrative that no longer serves humanity? Because the moment we choose differently, the moment we choose truth, everything changes. And that moment
can start right now. So now, why does America support Israel so blindly? My thoughts are tangled. Cold War strategy, evangelical Christian Zionism, AIPAC and lobbying networks, arms industry interests, shared intelligence and military cooperation, domestic political pressure, narrative control in Western media, or all the above. Israel violates international law. Global opinion shifts. American public opinion changes. U.S. interests are harmed. Human rights groups condemn Israeli actions. But we keep our eyes closed? Or do we just cover our eyes blind? Today, we confront the question that has shaped wars, toppled governments, rewritten borders, and defined the lives of millions of Palestinians. Why does the United States support Israel with such absolute, unconditional loyalty, even when the world sees the consequences? This is not a question of politics alone. It is a question of history, ideology, power, and the machinery of empire. And today, we pull back the curtain. For decades, American presidents have repeated the same phrase, Israel shares our values. But what values? Occupation? Segregation? Military rule over millions? Settlements built on stolen land? The phrase is not a description. It is a shield. A shield that hides the real reasons behind America's unwavering support. Because the truth is far more complicated. And far more deliberate. To understand America's loyalty to Israel, we must go back to the Cold War. The Middle East was the prize. Oil, trade routes, strategic bases, global influence. The U.S. needed a foothold, a reliable outpost, a regional enforcer. Israel became that outpost. In exchange for loyalty, Israel received weapons, money, diplomatic protection, political cover, and the relationship became a pillar of American strategy. Not morality, not democracy, strategy. Then came the lobby. AIPAC, think tanks, political donors, media networks, evangelical churches, defense contractors. A system designed to ensure that no American politician, Democrat or Republican, dares to challenge support for Israel. A system that rewards obedience and punishes dissent. A system that can end careers with a single headline. This is not conspiracy. This is politics. Documented. Public. Powerful. There's another force, one often ignored. Evangelical Christian Zionism. Tens of millions of Americans who believe Israel's expansion is part of a divine prophecy. A prophecy that requires Jewish control of the Holy Land, the rebuilding of the temple, and ultimately, the end of days. This movement funnels billions into pro-Israel causes. It shapes elections. It influences foreign policy. It pushes presidents toward unconditional support, not for Israel's sake, but for their own theology. America does not just support Israel. America arms Israel. Every bomb, every missile, every jet, every bullet. The U.S. military-industrial complex profits from every escalation, every war, every strike, every invasion. Israel is not just an ally, it is a customer, a testing ground, a showroom for American weapons. And war is good business. Behind the scenes, the U.S. and Israel share one of the closest intelligence relationships in the world. Cyber operations, surveillance technology, covert missions, regional espionage. Israel provides intelligence the U.S. cannot gather alone. The U.S. provides tools Israel cannot build alone. This partnership is deep, secretive, and mutually dependent. And it binds the two countries together, even when their interests diverge. For decades, American media portrayed Israel as the victim, the underdog, the democracy surrounded by enemies. Palestinians were invisible. Their suffering was minimized. Their voices were silenced. This narrative shaped generations of Americans. It shaped policy. It shaped elections. It shaped the national imagination. And it created a political environment where supporting Israel is the default
and questioning Israel is the risk.
But blind support has consequences. It has cost America credibility. It has cost America allies. It has cost America moral authority. And it has cost Palestinians their land, their homes, their lives. Every veto at the United Nations, every shipment of weapons, every diplomatic shield, all of it reinforces a system of occupation and apartheid. And the world sees it. But something is changing. Younger Americans are rejecting the old narrative. They see Gaza. They see the West Bank. They see the checkpoints, the demolitions, the bombings. They see the truth. And they are asking the same question we ask today. Why does America support Israel so blindly? The answer is no longer convincing. The excuses no longer work. The narrative is collapsing. American politicians know the public is shifting. They see the polls, they hear the protests, they feel the pressure. But they are afraid. Afraid of donors, afraid of lobbies, afraid of headlines, afraid of losing elections. So they continue the same policies, even when they know the world has changed. Fear is the glue that holds the system together.
And while America debates strategy, politics, and alliances, Palestinians pay the price. In Gaza, in Jenin, in Hebron, in Jerusalem. Families displaced, homes destroyed, children killed, lives shattered. America's blind support is not abstract. It is lived. It is felt. It is buried in the ground. So where does this go? Will America continue its unconditional support? Will the political system adapt to public opinion? Will the lobby lose its grip? Will the narrative finally break? The answer is not simple. But one thing is clear. The world is changing. America is changing. And the question we ask today, why does America support Israel so blindly, is becoming impossible to ignore.
Today, we peeled back the layers of a relationship built on power, fear, ideology, and history. A relationship that has shaped the fate of Palestine for generations. America's support for Israel is not blind by accident. It is blind by design. But designs can be challenged. Systems can be changed. Narratives can be rewritten. And today, more people than ever are asking the right questions. Despite all of the awakenings, I sadly want to say one thing. Finally, here is the core message. America supports Israel because the system is built to support Israel politically, militarily, financially, and ideologically. I'm Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine, and the truth is no longer hidden. Don't go away. I have more for you.
Let's see. What do I have for you next? Oh, yes. Next, I want to talk about the darkest Israeli war crimes ever recorded, based on the verified sources. So today, we confront a truth the world can no longer deny. Not because Palestinians said it, not because human rights groups documented it, but because Israeli soldiers filmed it themselves. A truth captured in selfies, live streams, TikToks, drone footage, and body-mounted cameras. A truth so raw, so brutal, so undeniable that international prosecutors call it a treasure trove of evidence. This is not rumor. This is not allegation. This is documentation recorded by the perpetrators. Today, we look at the darkest Israeli war crimes ever recorded, at least some of their crimes.
So, for decades, Palestinians described what was happening behind the walls, at the checkpoints, inside the prisons, under the rubble. The world said, "Where's the evidence? Where is the proof? Where are the videos?" Now, the evidence comes from the soldiers themselves.
Al Jazeera's investigative unit collected thousands of videos posted publicly by Israeli troops on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube. Soldiers laughing as they destroy homes. Soldiers posing with underwear they stole from Palestinian women. Soldiers filming themselves shooting unarmed civilians. Soldiers boasting about demolishing entire neighborhoods. This is the first war in history where the perpetrators live stream their own crimes, and they do it proudly. Investigators built a database of more than 2,500 soldier accounts. Faces identified, names matched, locations geolocated, dates confirmed. International law experts reviewed the footage and said, "This is evidence prosecutors dream of. This is unprecedented. This removes any possibility of denial." Because the soldiers didn't hide their crimes. They posted them. They wanted the world to see. One of the darkest patterns in the footage is the treatment of Palestinian detainees. Men stripped to their underwear, blindfolded, beaten, forced into degrading positions, paraded like trophies. Some soldiers laugh. Some pose for photos. Some mock the detainees as they cry. This is not interrogation. This is not security. This is humiliation as policy. International law calls it torture. Israel calls it standard procedure.
The videos show soldiers entering Palestinian homes, not in combat, not under fire, but casually. They open drawers, they steal jewelry, they tear family photos, they vandalize walls with racist slogans, they burn belongings, they destroy kitchens, bedrooms, children's toys. Then they film themselves blowing up the entire house. No military necessity, no strategic purpose, just destruction. Entire neighborhoods flattened, not because they had to be, but because soldiers wanted them to be. Some of the most chilling footage shows soldiers shooting unarmed Palestinians, a man waving a white flag, a teenager running for safety, a father searching for his child, a group of civilians trying to evacuate, shot on camera by soldiers who then upload the footage. Legal experts reviewing the videos said, "These are clear violations of international law. These are prosecutable war crimes." And the soldiers filmed them like they were filming a video game.
In video after video, soldiers brag about what they stole. Watches, cash, phones, clothes, food, family heirlooms. They film themselves wearing stolen items. They laugh as they ransack homes. They post captions like, "Souvenirs from Gaza." Looting is a war crime. But for these soldiers, it is content. The footage shows soldiers blowing up schools, hospitals, mosques, apartment buildings, water tanks, bakeries, power stations. Not during battles, not under fire, but deliberately, often while laughing. Entire blocks reduced to dust. Not because they posed a threat, but because they existed. This is not collateral damage. This is systematic destruction.
Drone footage, some leaked, some captured by resistance groups, shows Israeli forces firing on civilians from above. People running, people hiding, people searching for food, people trying to rescue the wounded. Targeted, one by one. The drones record everything. The operators speak casually, like they're selecting items from a menu. This footage is now part of international investigations. Also, there are some Israeli soldiers, after leaving Gaza, spoke to journalists and human rights groups. They described orders to shoot anything that moves, rules of engagement that treat all Palestinians as threats, commanders encouraging destruction, a culture of dehumanization, a belief that no one will ever be held accountable. Their testimonies match the videos. The crimes are not isolated. They are systemic.
Human rights organizations reviewed the footage and concluded war crimes, crimes against humanity, possible genocide. However, we all know it's genocide. Legal experts said the evidence is overwhelming. Governments expressed concern. But concern does not stop bombs. Concern does not rebuild homes. Concern does not bring back the dead. The world sees the crimes. but the world does not act. Israel has operated for decades with one guarantee: no accountability. Every investigation ends with the same sentence: no wrongdoing found. Every complaint ends with the same excuse: security. Every war ends with the same result: no one is punished. But this time is different, because the evidence is not coming from Palestinians. It is coming from Israeli soldiers, and the world cannot unsee it.
Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa said, "We live in the era of the first live-streamed genocide." She is not speaking metaphorically. The soldiers live-streamed the destruction, the killings, the humiliation, the looting, the torture, the burning, the bombing, the erasure of an entire people. They filmed it. They posted it. They celebrated it. And now the world watches. Let's take a deeper look here. Behind every video is a family, a home, a memory, a life, a child whose bedroom was destroyed, a mother whose son was executed, a father whose home was burned, a grandmother whose neighborhood was erased. The footage is not just evidence, it is testimony. Testimony of suffering, testimony of survival, testimony of a people who refuse to disappear.
Will there be justice? Will the ICC act? Will government stop sending weapons? Will soldiers face trial? Will commanders be held responsible? The evidence is there. The crimes are documented. The world knows. But justice requires courage. And courage is rare. Why is justice rare? I will tell you why. Because our governments are concerned, only concerned.
So we looked at the darkest Israeli war crimes ever recorded, not through the eyes of victims, but through the cameras of the perpetrators. This is the truth. This is the evidence. This is the record. And history will remember. I'm Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine, and the world can no longer say it didn't know. Stay tuned. We have more to cover.
Next. What's next? Okay. So here is what I'm going to talk about now. Buckle up, because the Middle East is entering what I can only describe as the post-American era. Yes, the thank you for your service, but we'll take it from here era. And the reason this matters is simple. You cannot lead a region when you refuse to stand for what is right. You cannot preach democracy while supporting actions that the world sees as collective punishment. You cannot talk about human rights while people watch live streams of suffering. You cannot promise peace while delivering weapons. And you definitely cannot claim moral authority while cheering on a war that many describe as a humanitarian catastrophe. And then there's the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway that became the world's most dramatic imaginary door. Trump kept saying he was going to open it. Open it from what? It was already open. It's like announcing you're going to open the sky or open the ocean. Sir, it's already open. It's been open. It never closed. But thank you for the enthusiasm. And then he said he might close it? No, he won't. He can't. He knows he can't. Iran knows he can't. The fish know he can't. Everyone knows he can't. We're not watching diplomacy. We're watching a circus. A circus with no ringmaster, no safety net, and definitely no script.
Okay, let me walk you through the show. Act 1. Trump announces, "We won the war." Iran replies, "We are now a regional power." That's not even a disagreement. That's two people reading from completely different books. Act 2. Trump declares, "Iran agreed to surrender the uranium." Iran responds, "You are lying. Not you are mistaken, not you misunderstood, but straight up, you are lying." Diplomacy has left the chat.
Act 3. Trump says, we now control the Strait of Hormuz. Iran replies, good luck. That's not a political statement. That's something your mechanic says when you tell him you're going to fix your own transmission. Act 4. And then, in a moment of pure geopolitical improv, Trump announces, we are going to destroy the Sultanate of Oman. Pause. Wait. Scream! What? Oman? Our allies? The country that minds its own business? The Switzerland of the Middle East? The nation whose foreign policy is basically, let's all calm down and drink tea? Weren't they our friends? I know you can't see me, but I'm scratching my head. Did we lose a bet? Did someone misread a map? Did autocorrect strike again? Anyway, Oman heard the threat and responded in the most Omani way possible. They opened all their trade routes with Iran. Every single one. And Iran? Iran said, we fully support Oman. Translation? Welcome to the club. Membership includes tea, dates, and immunity from American threats.
Okay, let me walk you through the show. Act 1. Trump announces, we won the war. Iran replies, we are now a regional power. That's not even a disagreement. That's two people reading from completely different books. Act 2. Trump declares, Iran agreed to surrender the uranium. Iran responds, you are lying. Not you are mistaken, not you misunderstood, but straight up, you are lying. Diplomacy has left the chat. Act 3. Trump says, we now control the Strait of Hormuz. Iran replies, good luck. That's not a political statement. That's something your mechanic says when you tell him you're going to fix your own transmission. Act 4. And then, in a moment of pure geopolitical improv, Trump announces, we are going to destroy the Sultanate of Oman. Pause. Wait. What? Oman? Our allies? The country that minds its own business? The Switzerland of the Middle East? The nation whose foreign policy is basically, let's all calm down and drink tea? Weren't they our friends? Did we lose a bet? Did someone misread a map? Did autocorrect strike again? Anyway, Oman heard the threat and responded in the most Omani way possible. They opened all their trade routes with Iran. Every single one. And Iran? Iran said, we fully support Oman. Translation? Welcome to the club. Membership includes tea, dates, and immunity from American threats.
This is what a post-American Middle East looks like. Countries are no longer waiting for Washington to tell them what to do. They're making their own alliances, their own decisions, their own futures, and they're doing it loudly. But here's the part that's both dramatic and, honestly, a little funny. The United States is still acting like it's the main character in a movie that everyone else stopped watching years ago. It's like showing up to a party you weren't invited to, holding a karaoke microphone, and insisting everyone listen to your song. Meanwhile, the region is moving on. New alliances are forming. Old assumptions are collapsing. And the world is watching the U.S. try to catch up to a story that has already turned the page. But let's be clear. This shift didn't happen overnight. It happened because of empty promises, selective morality, and support for actions that much of the world sees as unjustifiable. It happened because people are tired of being told to accept suffering as necessary. It happened because the credibility gap became too wide to ignore. And now, the Middle East is saying, we'll handle this ourselves. And honestly, they are. Iran is asserting itself. Oman is asserting itself. Saudi Arabia is asserting itself. Even tiny Qatar is out here playing 4D chess while everyone else is still setting up the board. The region is no longer waiting for America to lead. It is leading itself.
And the irony, the tragic, comedic, unbelievable irony, is that the U.S. helped create this moment by refusing to stand for what is right when it mattered most. You cannot support injustice and expect loyalty. You cannot ignore suffering and expect respect. You cannot treat people as pawns and expect them to play along forever. The Middle East is done playing along. And maybe, just maybe, this is the wake-up call the world needed. A reminder that power is not permanent.
A reminder that alliances are not unconditional. A reminder that moral authority must be earned, not declared. Because when you lose the trust of a region, you lose the influence that comes with it. And when you lose the influence, you lose the era. And that era, the American era, is ending. Not with a bang, not with a treaty, not with a dramatic speech, but with a series of announcements, denials, contradictions, and one very confused threat against Oman. And that, my friends, is where we are now. A world shifting, a region awakening, a superpower stumbling, and a future being rewritten in real time. So sit back, stay alert, and keep your sense of humor. Because if we don't laugh at some of this, we might just cry.
So now, let us talk about how we got here. Or maybe I should say, so now let us talk about Trump. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I mean President Trump. I have to get the title right because apparently titles matter more than results these days. Let us take a moment to appreciate some of his, let me choose my words carefully, some of his creative actions, innovative policies, and visionary announcements. Wait, I'm sorry again. I don't know what's wrong with me today. I meant to say some of his executive actions, policies, and announcements. Because when you put the word executive in front of anything, it suddenly sounds important. You know how some presidents walk into a room and you immediately feel leadership? Trump walks in and you immediately feel confusion. You don't know if he's about to announce a new world strategy or ask where the bathroom is. Let us review a few highlights from the Trump collection. This is the man who can take a simple idea, a normal idea, a logical idea, and turn it into a 47-page memo that somehow says absolutely nothing. You finish reading it and think, did I just learn something or did I lose brain cells? I can't tell. Trump is the only president I know who can make an announcement that sounds like a threat, a promise, and a cry for help all at the same time. He'll say something like, "We are entering a new era of operational synergy." And everyone in the room nods like they understand. But deep down, they're thinking, what does that mean? Are we getting fired? Are we getting a raise? Are we getting matching jackets? Are we getting in a new war? Or is the war over? What is happening? I mean, if you look at Pete Hegseth standing behind him, confused and thinking to himself, how did he get to be the U.S. Secretary of War? He thinks Trump thinks way bigger than what he can understand, so he simply nods in agreement. And then the policies. Oh, the policies! Trump writes policies the way some people write poetry, except poetry usually has meaning. Trump's policies are like IKEA instructions written in ancient hieroglyphics. You stare at them long enough and start questioning your life choices.
One time, he announced a new efficiency initiative. Great, sounds good. Except the initiative required 3 new committees, 2 new reporting opening the Strait of Hormuz that was open, and a weekly meeting to discuss how to close it. There was one unannounced committee in charge of how to reduce the number of meetings. By the end of it, the only thing that became more efficient was the speed at which people lost hope. And then there are the executive actions. Trump loves executive actions. He signs them like he's signing autographs. He'll walk into a room, grab a pen, and say, "I am issuing an executive action." And everyone braces themselves because nobody knows what's coming. Is he changing the dress code? Is he reorganizing the entire country? Is he banning microwaved fish in the war room? Nobody knows. Trump doesn't even know. He just likes the sound of it. But here's the thing. For all the confusion, for all the chaos, for all the moments where you wonder if he's running a country or auditioning for a reality show, you have to admit, Trump keeps things interesting. You never know what he's going to say next. You never know what policy is coming. You never know what executive action is about to drop like a surprise album.
And maybe that's the secret. Maybe Trump is not any president. Maybe he is Jesus. Didn't he post an AI of himself as Jesus not too long ago? A living, breathing reminder that leadership is not always about clarity. Sometimes it's about keeping everyone so confused that they don't have time to complain.
Sometimes it's about attacking the country that we are negotiating with. Sometimes it's about closing or opening the Strait of Hormuz. Depends on his mood. The Strait of Hormuz that on the Gulf of Mexico or maybe in the Dead Sea? So yes, let us talk about Trump. Let us appreciate the mystery, the unpredictability, the pure entertainment value of a man who can turn a simple announcement into a three-act play. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the President Trump Experience. Please fasten your seatbelts. There will be no refunds.
Okay, enough with our administration. Today, we witness a moment the United States never imagined. A moment when the empire that once dictated the fate of nations now struggles to control its own narrative. A moment when Washington retreats, when its arrogance collapses, and when a single spy threatens to destabilize Egypt, Turkey, and the fragile balance of the region. This is not the world America built. This is the world America can no longer manage. For decades, Washington walked through the Middle East with the confidence of a superpower. It issued orders. It drew red lines. It toppled governments. It funded wars. It shaped alliances. But today, that certainty is gone. The Gaza War exposed the limits of American influence. Israel ignored U.S. warnings. Arab states rejected U.S. pressure. Global opinion turned against Washington's double standards. And for the first time, the world saw something new. America is no longer feared. America is no longer obeyed. America is no longer in control.
So inside Washington, officials whisper the same sentence. We are losing the region. The signs are everywhere. Failed ceasefire negotiations, growing anger in Arab capitals, U.S. allies exploring ties with China and Russia, BRICS expanding into the Middle East. American diplomats sidelined in regional talks. The arrogance that once defined U.S. foreign policy is collapsing. Not because the world changed, but because of our actions.
And then came the espionage scandal. The Jonathan Pollard scandal. A spy, trained, funded, and deployed, infiltrating networks in Egypt and Turkey. A man who moved between capitals, collecting secrets, manipulating alliances, and feeding intelligence to foreign powers. His mission was simple: destabilize, divide, and weaken. His arrest exposed. Israel attempts to influence Egyptian politics, covert operations targeting Turkish security, intelligence wars unfolding beneath the surface, a regional struggle for control in the shadows. This was not just espionage. This was a warning. A warning that the Middle East is now a battlefield of intelligence agencies, American, European, regional, all fighting for influence in a world where Washington's dominance is fading.
Egypt reacted with fury. For Cairo, the spy case was not just a security breach, it was an attack on sovereignty. A reminder that foreign powers still believe they can manipulate the region from afar. Egyptian officials declared, "No one will destabilize this country again." The message was clear. Egypt is no longer a playground for foreign intelligence. Turkey saw the espionage case as part of a larger pattern, a pattern of foreign interference, covert operations, and attempts to undermine Ankara's regional ambitions. Turkey responded with arrests, counterintelligence operations, diplomatic pressure, public exposure of spy networks. Ankara sent a message to Washington and its rivals. We are not the Turkey of the past. We are a regional power, and we will defend our interests.
The Middle East is changing. Egypt is asserting independence. Turkey is expanding influence. Saudi Arabia is recalibrating alliances. And while the UAE is lost in the shuffle, Qatar is mediating global conflicts. Iran is rising. China is investing. Russia is intervening, and the United States, once the architect of the region, is now reacting to events it no longer controls. This is the collapse of arrogance. Washington's strategy relied on three pillars. 1, military dominance. 2, political pressure. 3, economic leverage. All three are failing. American bases no longer guarantee influence. American threats no longer intimidate. American aid no longer buys loyalty.
The Gaza war exposed the truth. The U.S. cannot pressure Israel. The U.S. cannot calm the region. The U.S. cannot dictate outcomes. The empire is retreating, not by choice, but by necessity.
The espionage case is more than a scandal. It is a symbol. A symbol of foreign desperation, declining American influence, rising regional autonomy, the intelligence wars shaping the new Middle East. The spy did not just threaten Egypt and Turkey. He exposed the fragility of a system built on manipulation and control, a system that is now collapsing. So what comes next? A world where regional powers act independently, alliances shift without Washington's approval, intelligence wars intensify, global powers compete openly. The U.S. is no longer the center of gravity. This is not the end of American influence, but it is the end of American dominance. The Middle East is entering a post-American era, shaped by its own interests, its own alliances, and its own calculations.
And where does Palestine fit into this new world? For decades, Washington used its power to shield Israel from accountability. But today, that shield is cracking. Global opinion is shifting. Regional powers are rising. American influence is fading. And the question is no longer, will the U.S. pressure Israel? The question is, can the U.S. pressure Israel? The answer, increasingly, is no. And that changes everything. Today, we witness the collapse of arrogance. The moment when Washington's dominance faltered, when a spy exposed the fragility of foreign influence, and when the Middle East began to reshape itself without American permission. This is not the world of yesterday. This is the world of now. A world where power is shifting. A world where nations are asserting independence. A world where the old empire is retreating. I'm Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And today, we saw the arrogance fall.
Before we close, I want to share details about several upcoming public events featuring congressional candidate Jonathan Paz. This afternoon, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., you are invited to meet him at Pavement Coffee House, located at 1663 Massachusetts Avenue, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138. Bring a friend, stop by for a conversation, and feel free to say hello. I will be there as well. If you cannot attend today, there is another opportunity tomorrow, June 1st, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Fika Spot, 619 Main Street, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02452. A third gathering will take place on Wednesday, June 3rd, from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Bubble Nation, 456A Massachusetts Avenue, Arlington, Massachusetts, 02474. These events are open to the public. They are spaces for dialogue, questions, and direct conversation. If you wish to learn more about Jonathan Paz's positions or address any concerns, these gatherings offer the chance to speak with him one-on-one. Let's stand together for what's right. Let's stand together for what we believe in. Let's stand together with Jonathan Paz.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The soft dimming of a candle, the quiet settling of dust after a long, honest conversation. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to dim, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that so often tries to smother it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour rooted in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not vanish when the headlines shift or when the cameras look away.
If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or opened a door you didn't know was there, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine or TWIP and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Falestine, hurra. You didn't hear this from me.
Trump said Iran has nothing. Said their radar is annihilated. Trump said their air force is destroyed. Trump said America controls the skies. Then America lost 42 aircraft.
Tiny hands against the wall, paper dolls begin to fall. Someone's running down the hall. Where did the light go? Where did the light go? Where did the light go? Faces I don't know. Where did the light go? Baby's blanket on the floor. Footsteps rushing through the door. Sirens getting louder more. Where did the light go? is turning red. Words that can't be left unsaid. Where did the light go? Where did the
fire, they came with lies, tore our homes from the earth and the skies, stole the fields where our children once ran, buried our names in the dust of the land. They took our plates and called them their own. Our streets, our songs, now a name unknown. They wrote new books with ink made of shame, but the wind still whispers our ancestors' names. You can hide the truth, but every stone remembers our youth. The sea still hums our lullabies. The olive trees won't forget our cries. The air still carries our stories untold. This land is ours, it won't be sold. It won't be sold. Look at their houses and land stolen from us. Windows that once held our mother's dreams. They changed their names to sound like they're from here. But the earth knows strangers when they're near. Ask the birds who sung here for years. Ask the waves that have dried our tears. The rocks still bear our children's scars. The moon still knows whose land we are. Ask the birds who sung here for yours. Oh, dig up our roots, pave over our graves, build your walls, spread all your hate, but the land breathes us in its face,
but the land breathes us in its face,
and one day it will speak.